like he is the king in waiting, is he's not yet.
He is the king in waiting. Wow, I didn't press the start button. Oh, well, we're talking about suffering Messiah. Yes, so David is the king in waiting. And there is a switch of dynasties there, which would explain why he would need to be anointed. We also have a story of Jehu. Remember, Elijah went to be to anoint Jehu. Who was Jehu before he was king? Do you remember the story? He was an army commander. So he was not a legitimate, he wasn't from a royal line.
He drove very fast.
He drove very fast. That's what we all know of us. He was a crazy driver. Yes.
He was a great guy because he went to ultimately uproot Ahab.
And so it's when, yeah, when there's a new line or you're leaving one line to another, you have anointing. Now, we'll back up a bit. So I've mentioned every man's Talmud and that there's a section on Messiah. And so some of the motifs of Messiah he brings out, he's quoting from the different, either the Talmud or different rabbinic sources. So in Pesachim, there is 54, page A, there are seven things quoted that were created before the world. Have you heard of this before?
Mm-hmm.
This concept that there were seven things at the foundation of the world. They are Torah, repentance, the Garden of Eden, or paradise, Gehinom, which roughly translates to hell, the throne of glory, the temple, and the name of the Messiah.
Mm.
So this is a tradition that in the founding of the world, these things were created. And of course, Torah, that comes from equating Torah and wisdom.
Can you do them again?
Right, before
Torah,
the foundations of the world, there was wisdom.
Torah, repentance, Garden of Eden, hell.
Gehinom, which is hell, the throne of glory, the temple, and the name of the Messiah. So in this quote, you have this concept that there is, not only is there a Messiah, it's obviously grown from being more than just an anointed king. At this point, it's something very special. It's a deliverer. And the name is known since creation. Of course, then they have this whole debate, well, what is the name? And no one can come up with an answer for that. There's another one in Pesikta Rabati, 152b. There's this quote, from the beginning of the creation of the world, King Messiah was born, for he entered the mind of God before even the world was created. And that's interesting. So then we have this discussion, well, what was his name? And so it's often we hear of Messiah, son of who?
David,
son of David, right? And people in Jesus' day, they cried out to him. What did they cry out?
Son of David,
have mercy on me. What are they saying when they say that? Son of David, what are they saying?
Messiah.
I mean, they probably knew his name was Yeshua, right? They know his name. Why didn't they use it?
Because it's like saying the equivalent of saying, let's say, King Yeshua. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's the equivalent of saying, you are the Messiah. When I'm calling you Son of David, I'm recognizing that you are Messiah.
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful. So when they're saying, Son of David, have mercy on me, they're saying, Messiah, I know who you are. Come, deliver me. So we have this idea that the Messiah is the son of David. Okay, so where in the Bible can we see this? I'm sure we can see it many places. Let's start maybe in Hosea 3:5. Hosea is one of those 12 prophets that are called the 12 minor prophets, not because they are minor, but because they are small, and they can all fit in a scroll. So Hosea is towards the beginning in your English Bible after Daniel. And he happens to be one of the earlier ones within the minor prophets. Hosea is a great book. If we were reading it in Hebrew, it would be very difficult. But since we're not, it's very easy. I did like that point. I was recently at a conference for foundations. Anyone involved in transmitting Bibles, whether it's translation, publishing, video, audio kind of stuff. And there was a presenter, Aaron Hornkoll, who's an old friend. He came here years ago. He mentioned that we need to remember as we read our Bibles, it's easy for us because we're reading translation. It's not easy when you read the original. And so, you know, a lot of people get here to Israel and like, well, why can't they just open this and understand? It says it right here. Well, because in the original, it might not be so clear. There might be different ways to understand it, or it's ambiguous, one, or just unclear because the words are old and you have to make sense of it in the context. And so it's like Shakespeare or anything else. You need helps to read it correctly, and you need notes.
Or Chaucer, even better example.
Chaucer, well, for sure, Chaucer.
Chaucer's completely unintelligible unless it's in modern English.
Unless we have helps.
Yeah.
Well, Shakespeare is better. There's a better difference between modern English and Shakespeare with us and the Bible. But maybe parts of Hosea sound more like Chaucer. But an educated English speaker can open Shakespeare and read it.
Right.
There will be parts where they're like, oh, I wonder what that means. But they can read it. Anyway, so just recognize the wonderful work your translators have done. They've actually made it easier to understand. And they have to choose. If there's a double meaning, you have to give one. So there are cases, any good translation, you're still going to need footnotes because there's no way you can understand what the other options were. So, all that aside, you're still in Hosea, right? Did everyone find the verse?
No, you didn't give us a verse.
I didn't give you a verse. Oh,
no.
I said chapter 3, verse 5. Should we back up? Okay. Afterward, the Israelites will turn and seek the Lord their God and their Davidic king, and David their king. Then they will submit to the Lord in fear and receive his blessings in the future. Okay.
I got in the last days.
In the last days.
Afterwards, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king.
Yeah.
They will come trembling to the Lord and his blessing and to his blessings in the last days.
What's
NIV?
What, NIV?
NIV, I think.
The problem with the phrase in the last days, acharit hayamim, it means in the future. It could be way in the future and it could be not so way in the future.
Right.
It's more generic. If you translated the last days, we immediately in English think of a certain theological thing. And that's not what is being communicated in Hebrew. And acharit hayamim, I mean, achar is later, you know, the last. But when you're facing, in Hebrew, lefanim is before. It's to your face. Because the logic is everything you've done, you can see. You can look at it. You don't know what's in the future. You can't see it. So it's actually behind you. So their concept is you see all the past and you're kind of walking like this into the future. So acharit hayamim is the, you know, the backside of the days, the end, the future. Anyway, that's not necessarily our point here. Sure. So Davidic king we have. Does anyone else have another thing for verse 5?
I've got David their king.
David their king, yes. David Malkam. David their king. So when is Hosea written? Or when did he live, let's say?
700.
Maybe even early. 700, maybe 800 BC. When is David? 900 something BC. So Hosea is writing, actually he's more, yeah, you're right, mid 700 BC, 8th century BC.
So he is writing probably at least 150, wait, what would you say David is? 900 something to 750. We're talking about 200 years at least.
It's a long time later anyway.
It's a long time.
He's many
generations, let's say.
And he's well and truly dead.
He's well and surely dead. David is dead when Hosea is speaking. So that gives a foothold to, well, how do we interpret this? They're going to come back and search for David, their king? So what could this be? And so then you have this concept of there's going to be someone like David. Or you could say maybe one of David's descendants. You have both those options. But so this concept of Messiah and being the son of David kind of comes from this Hosea 3:5 verse. Now, in Psalm 18:50, we can look there as well. He gives his chosen king magnificent victories. He is faithful to his chosen ruler, to David and his descendants forever. It's 51 in Hebrew. Magdil Yeshuot Malko, ve'ose chesed limshicho, le'David u'le'zar'o ad olam. So he makes great the salvations of his king. It's interesting here, my translation is chosen king. And he is faithful, or has loving faithfulness. This is covenantal love to his Mashiach, his anointed. And I have chosen ruler. What do you guys have?
I've got today, well, where are we? He gives his king great victories. He
right, the next one.
Unfailing love to his anointed.
His anointed.
To David and to his descendants forever.
Mm-hmm. So we have three things together. King, anointed, David, and his descendants, or actually technically his descendant, forever, his seed. Okay, so here we have, if you have an interpretation of this Messiah who's bigger than just a regular king, still somehow he's connected to David, right? David or a descendant of David. So this concept of the Messiah, a term of Messiah, could be the son of David.
You know, this really helps, because I always get baffled by these verses, because David is saying it. So he's saying, I've always read it as sort of a bit of an ego trip. He gives the king great victories, he shows unfailing love to his anointed, because after all he's anointed, to David
right.
And to his descendants forever. But actually it's got a messianic feel to it. Which,
yes. So well, there's another thing you can bear in mind. Not all psalms were necessarily written by David.
It says so pretty clearly.
Yes, yes and no. Okay, let's look at the beginning.
For the director of music.
Lam natzech le'eved Adonai, to the servant of God, le'David asher diber l'Adonai et divrei shira hazot. Okay, so, I mean, it's a title. It's attributed to him here. But in other things, you say, Le David, it could be that he wrote it, or it could be inspired by him for David.
Right.
So there are some other options of understanding it. But let's assume David wrote it, and David's a king. He could say, God is going to be faithful to my descendants because God put me here. He could still be talking in third person about himself and his descendants. I mean, if David's viewing it as something that God set in place, it's not an ego trip, because that's just what it is.
Right.
It's besides everything he does.
Can I ask you just to read what your translation is? What you've got in verse 50?
Verse 50? Okay, so this is the NET Bible. He gives his chosen king magnificent victories. He is faithful to his chosen ruler, to David and his descendants forever.
And did you go through the Hebrew?
Yeah, in the Hebrew, you want just the king part? It's Melech, Malko?
No, just go through it.
Okay. Magdil Yeshuot Malko, ועושה חסד למשיכו, לדוד ולזרעו עד עולם.
And how would you translate that?
He makes great victories. Yeshua is a victory or it's salvation. It can also be healing in some contexts. Magdil Yeshuot Malko. So he makes great the victories of his king, and he has loving or faithful love, I would say, covenantal love for his anointed one, for David, and for his seed forever.
And you said seed is singular.
It is here singular.
So it's one person they're talking about.
Well, not necessarily. You talk about seed. A seed grows into many.
Yeah.
So you could say offspring. Offspring is a singular word in English, right? But we're really referring to many children, not one.
And I've got descendants.
Yeah, so you have descendants. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have this son of David again. So back to this Talmudic debate and this idea that the name of Messiah was, before the creation of the world, there was a name of Messiah. And so they're debating, well, what is this name? Because nobody knows a name. And so the different schools find names in the Bible that ironically are similar to the names of their teachers.
Yeah.
But they pick messianic passages or passages that have been understood messianically. So the first is Genesis 49:10. And this is a nice, curious little verse. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. Okay, well, that's... Yeah. It's hard to understand this verse. It says in Hebrew, Ad ki yavo Shiloh. Until Shiloh comes, or until he comes to Shiloh. Shiloh is a name of a town where the Ark of the Covenant was for many years in Samuel's day. But here apparently it could be the name of a person coming. And so there have been traditions that have interpreted Shiloh as the Messiah. It's also my son's middle name.
That's also way before the Ark was in Shiloh.
Yeah, that's true. Way before the Ark was in Shiloh. But it is interesting that it is in the context of kingdom, rulership, right? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet.
Is there any understanding of ruler's staff between his feet to help us understand the cultural context? The staff between his feet?
I would say the staff and the ruler, Mechokek is the one who makes laws. He's a ruler. The staff is a symbol of leadership,
mm-hmm.
kingship, and so is Mechokek, the ruler. Now, Ben Raglav just again refers to descendants. It's actually euphemistic. Between his legs is how you create descendants. So really the parallel there is just that there's going to be a ruler from the descendants of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And they split it up into two poetic chunks.
I've got a lawgiver from between his feet.
Sure, lawgiver. That I have ruler staff and what did I say? Scepter. Ah, scepter was the first one and then
the
ruler staff.
The scepter doesn't depart from Judah nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. So the ruler's staff is like the rule of the king going on with his descendants.
Mm-hmm. Mechokek is the word we're talking about. You might hear chok in there. It's the one who sets the law.
Can you write it down?
Mechokek.
Mm-hmm. What do you like? Cursive?
Shabbat Shalom. Can we join
Shabbat
you?
Shalom, sure. Welcome. Come in. So we have Shiloh was understood as kind of like a secret name Messiah. There's another one in Psalm 72, 17. Yinon, that was not understood, but I don't know if we'll get into that, because Hanina and Jeremiah 16:13. And then other people say Menachem, son of Hizkiyahu. And then there's this funny mention. There's another tradition that's the leprous one of the school of Rabbi Yehuda the Prince.
Oh, over the place. Are we in Jeremiah 16:13 now? Or
no, we're skipping through that. I mentioned some other ones, but I don't want to go into detail because we'll not get to then our texts. So we had a taste of what the kind of interpretation they're doing of Shiloh. They're seeing it. It's kind of a hard text. It's got some mysteries about it, and it's interpreted messianically. So that was one of the names that attributed to Messiah. And I threw out Yinon as another name. Hanina, the Jeremiah 16:13 is Hanina. And Menachem is Lamentation 1:16. And in this list, again, this is a Talmudic discussion. In this list, towards the end, there's one called the leprous one of the school of Rabbi Judah the Prince. The leprous one. So there are some stories, some creative interpretations we call Midrash, about the Messiah being a leper. But the interesting thing is, in this same debate that I'm referring to, just as Genesis 49 was a proof text for Shiloh, what is the proof text for the leprous one of the school of Rabbi Judah the Prince? It is Isaiah 53:4.
Okay.
There you go. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. So we're going to be looking at Isaiah 53, and then maybe also Zechariah. Okay, so let's go to Isaiah 53, and we can start at the beginning, but we'll basically work our way to verse 4. Okay, I'll read for you from the NET Bible. Who would have believed what we just heard? When was the Lord's power revealed through him? He sprouted up like a twig before God, like a root out of parched soil. He had no stately form or majesty that might catch our attention, no special appearance that we should want to follow him. He was despised and rejected by people, one who experienced pain and was acquainted with illness. People hid their faces from him. He was despised, and we considered him insignificant. But he lifted up our illnesses, he carried our pain. Even though we thought he was being punished, attacked by God, and afflicted for something he had done. Okay, so again, we're reading in translation, so each of these chunks you could discuss what it means, really. But let's look at verse 4, because that's what was being quoted. What do any of you have different translations for verse 4?
Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted.
Okay. So, he took our illnesses, which, of course, if you look down further in verses 11 and 12, you can see that there's sin, and in a sense, illness is a metaphor for sin. And you could say it's also illness. I mean, I've heard this verse interpreted both ways, right? We're physically healed because of what Jesus did, and we're spiritually healed. Of course, I'm jumping to the interpretation. But so he took illnesses, he lifted our illnesses and our pains. He suffered. Okay, so this concept that he was suffering our pains, not his own. And we considered him Nagua. And it says this word nagua is touched, is struck. Nega. Nagua is the word. Nega, you can see, is a noun related to it. Nega is usually connected to illness, oftentimes connected to divinely inflicted illness. And particularly, nega is connected to what illness?
Leprosy.
So that is how you get to this, the leprous one of the school of Rabbi Judah the Prince, which they quote this verse, and in our quotation, we get it in English, so we don't even see the connection to leprosy. But yet we esteem him stricken. Stricken is this word, nagua. So stricken with, apparently, leprosy. Now, what else, for any of you out there who might have some background, what other place can you hear nega in? A strike. Think of divine.
In the Bible.
In the Bible, yes. Anyone?
The king from Babylon that was stricken for his son.
Ah, okay.
It was pride. It wasn't leprosy, but he was stricken.
He was stricken, yeah. And I don't know. The problem is that's in the Aramaic side, so we'll probably, I haven't checked that, what the verb is there, but probably not using this word.
Would
it be Hezekiah? Definitely, you mean Uzziahu? Uzziah?
Wasn't Hezekiah stricken?
With nega? I guess what I'm trying to ask is this specific word for stricken, not just getting sick. You're right, he did get sick, and sick unto death. And, but the word nega, you write that with Uzziahu, King Uzziahu that went into the temple.
Mm-hmm.
He was struck with leprosy using the same root.
The last plague in Egypt.
There you go.
Yeah.
Since we're on Passover, the last plague of Egypt. Od nega ehad. It's as if God is putting down his finger. I have one more finger to inflict you with. One more touch. Nega. I should mention lagaat. You know you have words related in different languages, right? Lagaat is to touch.
Would negat be connected, like to be against?
Nega?
Negat.
No, well, that's a different root. Different root, yeah. But this is a touch that is not nice. I mean, it's a harsh thing. So the last plague of Egypt, od nega echad, and I think maybe even, I'm totally going off of memory now, but you know when the ark gets taken to the land of Philistines?
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be there too as well, that there was nega in, went from town to town and it kept inflicting people with diseases.
Yes, they got boils and things, didn't they, or
yes.
Tumors.
Something.
Some weird things, yeah.
Something. Not in the brazen serpent. No, I don't think so. In Samuel? Well, for sure, magefa. I guess we could check through all the stories and see if there's any nega or lenagea in there.
So tell us again the word that we get nega, we get a stricken.
Stricken, yeah.
Stricken.
In my translation, you get a stricken.
I think I've got stricken.
It might be, yeah. So stricken, nagua. Sorry, nagua is when you're describing the person. Then you are stricken. Nega would be the thing, the strickenness, the strike.
And the implication is, biblically, scripturally, that nega is linked to leprosy.
It's linked to leprosy. You could illness.
Okay, just
Let's see, it can be divine, like plague, illness, and specifically leprosy.
And who was the guy who said that the name of the Mashiach, Judah the Prince, you said, or something?
Well, that was this tradition recorded in the Talmud. Says someone suggested, I don't know who suggested, the leprous one of the school of Rabbi Judah the Prince. And I don't know which leprous one they're referring to. Someone who is leprous. The point is that they have this concept that the Messiah would be a leper.
Right.
That's the shocking thing.
And there's a place in the Gospels where Jesus said of the Nazarenes would believe in him that they'd all be healed. And they come back with a parable and said, physician, heal thyself, which would insinuate that he was, maybe he did have some kind of disease. Or there's some kind of something to say him apart from everybody else to where they would say there's something wrong with him physically or whatever.
Possibly, or at least following the metaphor, you know, that's an analogy. So in the same way a physician heal yourself, you could say, if you have this power, do it for yourself, kind of thing.
He was treated as a leper, though. He was avoided.
Well, that's the interesting thing. What else does leprosy do?
It separates you. It makes you untouchable.
You're untouchable. You're not allowed in the temple.
No.
You are... You are unholy, basically. You're cut off.
Outside the camp.
And you're outside the camp. But the interesting thing also in this Isaiah thing, it's not just that he's afflicted. He is muke Elohim. Right? He's struck by God.
Yes.
We think that God struck him. So there's this idea, oh, and afflicted. That's the last. Or even punished. Could be the last word translated there. And so the idea is when people get sick, it's a very common thing to assume that they're sick because of what they did. It's in ancient cultures, it's in modern cultures even. Oh, well, you must have done something really bad to deserve this. Mm-hmm. And so when they see him so stricken, just like Job's friends, right? Well, you must have done something terrible. And yet, Jesus goes against that understanding when he says, do you think the person born blind did anything bad to be born blind? No, but we've all done something bad. And he turns it around. So when you think of these understandings of Messiah, just remember that verse 4 of Isaiah 53 has this image of a Messiah who is deathly sick, who is stricken, and that people understood him to be stricken by God. And yet, in the beginning of the verse, he suffered our sicknesses. So even in that, even in this verse, they're giving you the true interpretation. They're saying, we all thought you were just stricken from God because of what you did, but actually, it was our sins or our illnesses. Here, illnesses is the metaphor. It was our icky, yucky, bad stuff. If you want to think of our sin as leprosy, that was the stuff on him. It was ours. So it's quite a powerful little verse here. I think it's contrasting what was really going on to how we considered him. So we considered him stricken by God, but what was really going on is his strickenness was because of us. So we thought he was being punished physically for all the bad he'd done, but he was taking our punishment on him. So it's rearranging it, and we esteemed him not. I don't know why they put that at the end. Sure, I'm sure many people didn't esteem him. If you're talking about Jesus, yes.
I mean, the reality is, here is this person who would appear to, let's say he's leprous.
Uh-huh.
Let's say that that's the way he was seen. He's despised, and we held him in low esteem. I mean, somebody you meet, the bag man on the street,
mm-hmm.
You hold him in pretty low esteem, if you're honest.
Sure.
You
well,
know,
people who have serious health issues, people tend to look down on them in natural.
Yeah,
they're
not coping.
Perspective.
They're on the lower whatever.
I actually like the NET Bible here for this verse because it shows a contrast. He lifted up our illnesses. He carried our pain, even though we thought he was being punished, attacked by God, and afflicted for something he had done. So there's that contrast there.
But the low esteem is the verse before.
No, the low esteem is how it's translating chashavnuhu. We considered him. Okay, wait, no, you're doing the verse. Okay, you're I see what you're saying.
She was in verse 3 just now.
Okay. Cause there's two chashavnuhus. Okay, so in verse 4, I was talking about the chashav nuhu in verse 4. Verse 3 has a chashav nuhu, exactly the same. So, okay, so let's go look at verse 3. He was despised and we considered him insignificant, is what Net has. Yeah, and so basically he's being shunned because he has a terrible disease.
So the other translation,
yeah.
It says, he was despised as one from whom people turn their faces.
Okay,
is that
yeah. Master panim is hard to translate it. Hiding of your face. And as a hiding of a face from him,
okay.
He is despised, and we didn't consider him.
In English, would you say turn your back?
Well, you can hide your face. When something's really gross, you hide your face. If someone's really injured, they got blood everywhere, or let's say they're leprous and things are falling off, your instinct is to look away, right? I think that's what it's talking about.
I passed a leprous person in East Jerusalem just recently. And, and you look away because you don't want to humiliate them by staring at them.
Right. Now, the one other thing I will point out is Sara'at, this disease that is translated leprosy in the Bible, is not
yes.
actually Hansen's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the leprosy we know where eventually your fingers fall off, that kind of thing. But it is a serious skin disease and was considered to be contagious, which is part of the reason they're so restricted and put away. Jacob Milgram, who's a Jewish scholar, he thinks leprosy was so in the realm of uncleanness because it made you look death-like. There's something about the whiteness or something that would connect you to looking like death, and everything kind of connected to death is unclean.
Which is which it says in the story of Miriam when she gets leprosy. Doesn't it say she goes white?
She's yeah, white as snow, that's right. Leprous as snow, it says.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, someone born dead. So there is that, the look of leprosy, whatever it was, I shouldn't use the word leprosy then, this look of this serious skin disease was death-like. So...
Are you saying now it's not really leprosy, it's some other disease?
Right.
Which makes sense, doesn't it, medically speaking? Because if it's Hansen's degrees, it really is if you're going to be cured from Hansen's, it really does need a miracle of major whatever.
I've heard... Yeah.
But if it's a skin disease, you know, you have to go out to the camp for 7 days and wash
right.
yourself and come
and it
back
can be
to,
cured.
And no matter what faith you had in those days, I'm absolutely sure if it was real leprosy, nobody would believe that in 7 days you'd be back all clean.
However, I have heard in earlier stages of Hansen disease you can be cured. It's just if it gets out of control, then you can't.
Right, that may well be.
But the other thing is Uzziahu, he was cut off from the palace
right.
for the rest of his life,
right.
so he wasn't cured either.
They didn't
right.
have antibiotics then.
You didn't have antibiotics either.
You can stop. Mm-hmm. You can stop Hansen's disease in the modern age at any stage from progressing
right.
with the correct medication.
Yeah,
Okay, so
and I'm proving it all the time.
There's another interesting verse here in Isaiah I wanted to think about. The next verse. He was wounded because of our rebellious deeds, crushed because of our sins. He endured punishment that made us well. And because of his wounds, we have been healed. Okay, so that's a very quoted verse, right? It's quoted in both the context of salvation and the context of physical healing. Right? You've heard it used both ways?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it also cited by one of the Gospels, the writer of one of the Gospels? I think we just read through all four Gospels the other day, Jesus' crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of them saying, and this was to fulfill the prophecy, he was pierced for our transgressions.
Right. Yeah, so here he's definitely, he's pierced for our, but they're not transgressions. Well, I guess...
I've got transgressions.
Yeah. No, transgressions is good. All these big words in English confuse me. They're not iniquities here. Pesha is something you do on purpose. It's a sin on purpose. You could say it's a crime. It's a... Yeah. So he was... Either he was holed, as in pierced, put a hole in him for our crimes, or he was made unholy for our crimes. And really, either one could fit the context. He was meduka, he was crushed or oppressed from our iniquities. And the discipline or the punishment of our peace was on him. That's a very interesting phrase that's hard to understand. And the next one is even more interesting that we've been talking about. Uvahavurato nirpalanu. And this is getting into beyond my field, but chavura is actually how it's pointed here, and not habura. Habura is what they're translating. Do you hear a difference?
Yeah.
One is v, one is ba. So habura is a known word for a wound or a bruise or some kind of whack, physical whack. Havura is not pointed, though, which makes it look like actually a noun from another verb we know. Lechaber is to join. You know, in the tabernacle, all the thing, the curtains are joined together. It's a group. It's a joining. And it's interesting that the Masoretic text has actually preserved a pointing that doesn't fit the word that most people translate.
Which one are we on now?
This is because of his wounds. It's this word, his wounds.
So how would you use havura there?
Havura? Well, you could say because of, or you wouldn't say because of, you would say in his joining we are healed. Well, that's a good question. If you could say it in joining in his... No, so I'm thinking about it. If the concept of is in joining, his joining in suffering that isn't his, we are healed. You could understand that way. Or our joining in his suffering, we are healed. Like in our baptisms, we join in his death and resurrection metaphorically. So it's interesting, but it doesn't make as much sense in the context as the other word, habura. So most people just translate as if it says habura.
The interesting thing at the beginning of that verse, we've got some opposition here.
Also,
he was pierced for our transgressions, which is sins or rebellion or some such, right? It's what we do, that word.
Yeah.
But he was crushed for our iniquities, and I've always understood iniquity to be the...
what passes down.
Yeah.
Part of, like, human fallenness.
The human fallenness inside me. It's not...
yeah.
It's not something that I can deal with, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when in Psalm 51, when David's repenting over Bathsheba and Uriah and the whole thing, he says, in sin did my mother conceive me.
Mm-hmm.
All, and I can't remember exactly, was it? Because, and I've always,
you might have used both there, though.
Yeah. But it's always understanding that, I mean, it could be that he was an out-of-wedlock son. You know, we don't
really know
about him.
Right.
And but that had to be dealt with. But it was what his actual deed was he was responsible for.
Yeah, definitely. And they both need dealing with. The next phrase of the punishment or the discipline of our peace or our wholeness was on him, I think is a very difficult one to understand. But my translation says, he endured punishment that made us well. Shalom has this concept of wellness. Everything is as it should be. We have related words like shalem, to be whole and complete. But you have to interpret this one because it doesn't give you a lot of verbs to work with. The discipline of our peace is on him.
What is discipline? What is the Hebrew word?
Musa.
And what is
I mean, depends on the context, right? But it's often referred to in Proverbs. Accept discipline. In our translation here, it uses punishment. So discipline maybe sounds cleaner than punishment. I don't know.
Well, punishment, God has to punish sin.
Yes, he has to punish sin. But if you use punishment in all those contexts in Proverbs, some of them wouldn't make sense.
Right.
So discipline is more than punishment. But it could include punishment, if that makes sense.
Discipline is for restoration, though, is it not?
Sure, yes.
So it's to make whole, to make new again,
right,
to restore us unto the Father.
So what the discipline we should have gotten, the discipline that should have brought us peace is on him.
Mm-hmm.
That's
when you bring up Proverbs, it makes you think of discipline as a father's love.
Right.
And guiding.
Bringing us back into restoration.
Yeah.
I have a thought that I feel like I need to share. The idea of the word wound also having a marking that would indicate a different word that means joined. If sin is separation from God, Jesus being one with God is, and he's our intercessor.
Right.
That allows us to have healing.
Right.
And be joined back with God.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I see a way how either meaning could actually fit nicely there. Definitely.
I mean, that's amazing, because I was in John 17 this last few days. And I and my Father are one.
Yeah.
I am joined.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm praying for those that you have, Father, have given me.
So they might be one as we are one.
So that they, us, might be one as we are one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
so
it is so incredibly deep, and I've not seen it in terms of this word, just join. You know, we think it's a bit way out.
Could you please give me the Hebrew word for that again so I can remember?
Chavura.
Chavura.
Chavura is the Hebrew word we're talking about. Now, habura is a wound.
It's spelled the same, but without the dots
underneath. I have a quote from Proverbs about habura. Haburot, it's actually in the plural here. Beatings and wounds cleanse away evil, and floggings cleanse the innermost being.
Charming.
Yeah, so that's the habura.
That's too popular.
I'll tell you.
What's the infinitive of the word?
Well, it's a noun.
The joining.
Oh, lechaber, okay. would be the joining.
When you said that it's adjoining, like the temple or the
curtains in the tabernacle are joined, each one together.
I'm
yeah.
Curious what the word is or what the reference is when that was ripped apart, because that image
well,
in my mind is of unjoining to give us access.
Right, well, those are two different curtains. I was referring to the curtains around the tabernacle that are called the Yeriot. That big, thick curtain that separates is the Parochet. And that was woven of many strands. Let me think. I think it's Shazur, though. Do you remember, Nick? For the Parochet, I don't know if you have Chibur or anything connected to this verb there. But yeah, you can draw different metaphors from the tabernacle. There is one more verse. Oh, we don't have time.
Zechariah?
Yeah, Zechariah 12:10. There is another verse in Sukkah 52a that says, "The Messiah, son of Joseph, was slain, as it is written. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son." But apparently this concept of the Messiah being the son of Joseph came into being later than Jesus' time, probably after the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD, because it was a failed revolt. And in fact, messianism in general got suppressed because of this revolt. And so nowadays, it's not so dominant as it was in Jesus' day. But there is this concept of a suffering Messiah that exists. You see it hinted at in texts, and not only in the texts as Christians understand it, but in texts as Jews have understood it. Even though they don't affirm the Christian interpretation, they still see the suffering Messiah as a motif somewhere in there. So it's a validating in a roundabout way. But yeah, there's so much more we could talk about even in this Isaiah passage. But as a takeaway, besides the chavura, take that and chew on it. Isaiah 53 is a wonderful, powerful passage. And just remember, when you read it in English, it's much clearer to you than it is in Hebrew. So if you ever go out and you're talking to someone who is Jewish, and you're like, well, why don't you just get it? It's written right here. Well, there are reasons they don't just get it, because it's not so simple to get. And yet, when you do study it, I do think that it affirms Jesus more than any other interpretation out there. I was reading just a standard Israeli commentator, and they seem to be saying one thing and then they go back to the other, because the way they understand suffering servant is the people of Israel. But then how can it be people of Israel if it says, I've taken the sufferings of my people? The people's taken of my people, it doesn't make sense. And so it has to actually be an individual. And it's going into such detail about this individual. It needs to be an individual. But then at the end, you know, they're saying, well, it can't be Jesus. But it's like, they don't actually really give a good reason why it can't be. So I kind of like that. So there is some mystery in it, but read it, have it on the tips of your tongue, and you can always talk about it with people and ask them, how do you understand this? You know, and encourage them to think about it and talk about what some of these things, how you could see it being understood and how it fits with the interpretation. So Shabbat Shalom, and you're welcome to go downstairs during the worship service. And we will keep thinking about the wounds that make us healed.